remember, the passion for destruction is also a creative passion.
Yo, we're live, Friday the 3rd.
Yay.
It's great. It's great stuff, Friday the 3rd, 2009. It's post G20 lockdown.
Yeah, part two of the G20 shows.
And tonight we're going out on our usual station, and we're out on Indie Media London as well. Cheers to them dudes.
Yeah, big up.
Absolutely. So on tonight's show, we've got a bit of a clear up of things that have happened since our last show. We've got some information about some of the issues at the convergence centres.
Yeah, two of them were basically hassled like crazy by the cops, Rampart and Earl Street, and we'll be hearing from them. We did a quick interview with the War on Want and their opinions about the G20 protests and how they went and what was achieved. We've got some audio from the G20 meltdown demo, which we didn't hear from so much because it was kettled and contained, but Paolo did some great stuff there, so we'll hear from that. We're going to have some announcements, and we're going to talk to the Sex Workers Open University that's actually taking place as we speak. They're like downstairs in Lark, and there's loads of pictures everywhere. It's great.
They've got this really cool exhibition going on, and they're doing some workshops here this weekend, so yep, we'll have a chat with them.
And we talked to Richard from Climate Camp about their opinions, and we're going to be doing a media analysis as well.
We'll have a chat about what the mainstream are shitting on about these days. So, we got Ronan, who's DJing for us tonight, which is wicked. Ooh. It's really good. Nice one, dude. Cheers for coming in. So, we're going to rock on with an interview from Paolo.
Why did you come here today? I'm out for a bit of my lunch, actually, to see what's going on.
Right, you're working here?
Yeah.
What do you think of the demo? I mean, it's not a violent demo, as all the media said.
Well, yeah, it's a very peaceful one. It's very peaceful at the moment, but you never know. It only takes a minute or two, and then things can change.
Yeah, mate.
I just come to have a look and just see what's happening.
Yeah. So what do you think? Do you think that the demands of the people here are right? That people are right to protest?
Yeah, probably, but half of them don't know what they're talking about, so... Yeah, but everyone, you know,
Free
will, you've got a right to protest, but most people just come along just to see what's going on rather than actually believing in it.
Yeah. So what is the atmosphere like in the financial sector? I mean, about Manchester,
it's difficult,
we're worried.
It's very difficult, but, you know, most people who work in banks, you know, are just ordinary people who just got paid ordinary money. So I think sometimes the whole sector can be vilified when it's just a few people at the top.
Yeah.
It was
very easy to get in.
Oh, it's really easy to get in, not so easy to get out.
They're going to stay here.
I think they're going to keep us here for some time, but I guess you can't leave the party too early, you know, and the cops are just trying to keep the party going.
Yeah. That's right. So what do you think? I mean, it's been very peaceful so far, so all the freedom here was...
Yeah, absolutely. There's been no problem at all. Yeah. No, it's been good. Everyone's been smiling. It's a beautiful day. It's beginning of spring.
Is there an issue you're particularly concerned about to come here today?
Yeah, this is part of this whole anti-globalization movement that's been going for some time, and people have ignored this movement for a long time, and I don't think the anti-globalization movement was against globalization, but people have been warning that this is for a very small minority of the world that's benefiting, while everyone else is suffering, and the planet itself isn't able to cope with what's going on. So it's good that the world's sort of increasingly communicating and trading with each other, but what we're worried about is that this should be for everyone and not just for a small minority, parasitic elite.
Keep people like that, supporting people like that.
No,
peaceful demonstration.
No, we have a right to a free movement, democracy. We're just here protesting in a democracy, perfectly normal protest. We're allowed to do that. We're allowed to travel freely. They're imprisoning us. I call that false imprisonment. It's a crime. It's a crime. It's if somebody's grabbed you and stopped you moving.
Yeah.
That's a crime.
Yeah.
I think the police are committing a crime against thousands of people. I just asked that guy. Can I get out? We should be allowed to travel, to move, really. I mean, it's not democracy, is it not?
Yeah. Well, you're right.
Would you agree that?
Yeah, definitely.
I asked a policeman there, I can't go, I can't leave this area.
Yeah. But when did you come here today for a demonstration?
I came to demonstrate because I'm angry, like everybody, and like millions and billions of people in the world are angry against governments and big business running our lives and stealing money from us.
Yeah. Were you working in or what was your sector you're working in?
No, I'm retired.
All right,
I work in charity, but I'm still a retired charity worker.
Just give me to have a look what's going on.
Yeah. So you're working around here in the area?
No, we're working around London.
All right.
We're station reps.
Okay.
So
Can you come here for a demo or for the yesterday? I mean,
today, here in protest.
London or you can come to protest?
Just have a look, yeah.
All right, great.
Yeah.
What's the job?
I'm a stationary sales rep.
All right.
Yeah.
So do you think the people here are right in the protest?
I think to the extent they're right, yeah. Yeah, I agree with a lot of what they're saying. Yeah.
I mean, what is the issue in particular that you share the most with the protesters?
I'm sorry?
What is the issue?
I think with the way that the banks have handled the crisis. A little bit of justice of the pensions and the payoffs. I'm fully with them on that one.
Because there's also middle class people that are like losing jobs, losing houses.
That's right. Well, because there's really few that people are suffering, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's absolutely right, the right people are doing here, yeah.
To demonstrate for better financial regulation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Are you working in the city yourself?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Leaning the bank, leaning...
I can't
say the bank, they would probably win, like...
Yeah, like banking sector, right?
Yes.
So, but do you think that the demonstrators that came here today are right in their protest?
I think they're very vague in that they don't have... they're not proposing any solutions. They're just... It's a very general protest. And, you know, anger is right, but equally you have to do something constructive.
Yeah.
Here's an interview I did with a member of the Rampart Collective. To give you a bit of background, while the G20 summit was going on, several demonstrations took place, including a giant game of Monopoly outside the Stock Exchange and several hundred protesting outside the Excel Center. A remembrance event also took place outside the Bank of England near to where Ian Tomlinson died during the previous day's demonstration. All of this was heavily policed, and at the same time, in what seems to be quite a cynical display of power, hundreds of riot police raided two buildings associated with the protests, one of which is Rampart. I understand that you were there when it was raided. Maybe you can...
Yeah, sure. I got there at about 11 o'clock in the morning, and there was a police van diagonally across the end of Rampart Street near Commercial Road, and another one that I could see further down Rampart Street. And there were a lot of what looked like 15 around, but they didn't search me at that point. But I'd been in the building about an hour. We started to hear a helicopter, and we were actually having a collective meeting on the second floor, and there were six of us in the room, and we were looking out of a window, and we could see another van arrive with some ladders on the roof, and then we saw some guys walking around in like harnesses, which looked like a climbing team. And one of the collective went down to speak to the police and was sort of like, what's going on? But, you know, if you show us a warrant, we'll let you in the front door. But they kind of said okay, but then just didn't produce anything. And then we knew that they were like, getting up on the roof. And we kind of stayed in the room and we could hear them on the roof. And then we actually heard them breaking through the roof door, the door at the top of the stairs which leads to the roof. Which we had barricaded, so obviously they moved our barricades. And I don't know how many officers, I actually didn't count, but it seemed like the room was absolutely full suddenly of black-suited officers with riot shields and tasers. They were pointing tasers at us and yelling at us, get down, get down. I was at that point sending a text message to try and get help. And I kind of carried on sending the text message, so I wasn't getting down quickly enough, and one of them pushed me down by my shoulder. They then told us to put our hands on our heads. I tried to put my phone back in my pocket, and one of them yelled at me, leave it, leave it. They then handcuffed us with our hands in front of our bodies and sat us in chairs in the office. And the same thing was happening. I didn't know at the time there were two people that were visiting that were sleeping in the next door room, and the same thing was happening to them. They took our details. They wanted names, addresses, dates of birth, and said something to the effect that they had intelligence that organisers of the violence that happened on Wednesday were at Rampart, and that they would send our details somewhere, and I can't remember exactly where they said or whether they said at all, and if we turned out not to be the people that they were looking for, then they would let us go. Basically, then we sat around for a while. One thing that happened was that they suddenly realised they had two women in the room. One of the guys got on the radio and said, you know, we have two women here. One police officer turned up and dealt with the other female member of the collective that was in the room, but I was guarded by a man the whole time. They took us then into the room door one by one, photographed us front and back. They photographed my face, my hands in the handcuffs, my back, and then they put a video camera down my body and they focused for quite a while on my feet, which I thought was kind of ridiculous considering the amount of pairs of shoes I've got, but anyway, we won't go there. They asked, this is the third time they took my details, this time they asked, where were you born? And I said, London. And the guy said, I want to know where in London, where was the hospital? Which I thought was a very strange question. So I said, well, I think it was a nursing home somewhere in Hampstead. And he said, Hampstead will do, which is like very peculiar. Anyway, I have no idea what that was about. I was then taken to the other side of the room and searched by a female officer. She gave my purse to a mail officer who went through all the cards. We then sat around again, and during this time, they're actually trying to be provocative. They were saying some very strange things. I understand from one of the other members of the collective, they were saying something about the guy that died on the demonstration and laughing about it. I actually couldn't hear it, my screen's not that great. But while we were in the room where we'd been photographed, they were talking about sausages for some bizarre reason. I mean, thing I can imagine is that they thought we were vegans and it would upset us, but I'm not. and it didn't, obviously. They then back into the other room and I couldn't see my phone. And they had made me put my phone down on the chair and I couldn't see it. And so I asked, where's my phone? And one of the officers picked it up off the desk and put it back down again to show me that it was there and safe. We then sat around a bit longer. They received messages on their radios, presumably about us, but they were no matches on their little database. And eventually took off the handcuffs. And by this time they were getting a bit conciliatory, trying to start conversations and finding common ground. I mean, one of them started the conversation with Paolo and myself about Jackie Smith, and when we kind of agreed with what he was saying, he said, look, there's common ground, so I'm not quite sure what part of their training requires them to do that. they eventually took off the handcuffs and told us not to come upstairs for 5 minutes. The first thing I did was check my phone, and they'd left it on the screen, which was the sent messages screen, which I thought they would do. I thought they would want to look at the last message I sent, but it was in fact a message I sent on the Wednesday that they'd been reading, which was a very fluffy message about, hey, we're having a picnic outside the Bank of England. That's pretty much it. I know that one member of the collective was arrested. I know that he's been released now, but I haven't yet been able to speak to him.
It was a really aggressive infiltration of the building. They didn't try and take the space from you, which is interesting, because that's what they did at the Earl Street, basically, at the same time. All they seemed to want was the people in the building that they think were associated with some of the property destruction that had happened, the day before.
That was my impression, and I'm still wondering why they didn't take the building.
Yeah.
I really can't get my head around that. I mean, it's great that they didn't take the building, but I would really like to know why.
How do you feel in terms of the tactics that were used? And it sounds, from your account, quite aggressive and very unnecessary.
Yeah, unnecessary, aggressive, over the top, and completely pointless. I mean, if you were looking at it from a taxpayer's point of view, you'd say a complete waste of money. I got the impression that it was staged. I think, you know, this intelligence they were talking about, I'm trying to get my head around that, and I think it was a report in the Evening Standard the day before which said something about organisers being based in squats in East London, which, of course, the police might have said the Evening Standard as an excuse, but of course it's not a good enough excuse, but it was violent. I can't say I'm injured, other than a small bruise on my knee, but it was incredibly aggressive. I'm supposed to say that the collective was a lot more calm than they were, but seemed actually quite scared. But at the same time, as if they'd been studying Hollywood movies in order to know what tactics to use.
So do you think that this tactic was meant to deter people from coming to Rampart, from being associated with it, and also to scare the collective members in being associated with Rampart?
I think they were definitely trying to scare us. In fact, I got the impression with the conversation they were having about being pleased the protester died, various other things that they were saying, was supposed to wind us up. I think they were hoping that we would react with violence, which of course we didn't. I mean, in fact, we were looking at each other across the room and shrugging our shoulders, so they didn't get what they wanted.
And how about the previous day on April 1st, did you participate in any of the action that was happening down in central London?
Yeah, we were with the Black Horse March, and we were kettled outside the Bank of England, and it was a sunny day, and at one point we were sitting down having a picnic. I actually didn't see what happened to the Royal Bank of Scotland. It was all happening, you know, I didn't even hear it, to be honest. But at one point, I know that people must have broken through police lines because that's how we got out.
Yeah.
And that was quite early in the afternoon. It must have been about 2:30 or 3.
And how do you feel being there achieved any sort of aim? Like, for example, you were there obviously for a particular reason. Do you think you achieved anything
Yeah, I'm always really ambivalent about these things, but I think it is important to be there. I think, first of all, force of numbers makes a difference. I think the right sort of media attention makes a difference. Of course, that's what we never get. But on the other hand, there was a guy there from the International Tribune who was asking the questions. Another member of the collective had a person from the Christian Science Center, which is obviously not a publication we generally support. But I guess that we're articulate and state, the reasons why we're there, then it's worth doing. Yeah, it's definitely worth doing. I could not do nothing.
So, yeah, we're currently in a small room on the first floor of the Earl Street Convergence space, which maybe about 20 minutes ago was broken open by many riot cops swinging batons around and pointing taser guns at people through doors. They made it through our barricades and some of us have retreated up into a small room. There's about 20 of us in here.
Yeah, at about, I think it was about, what time in the morning?
What time did you wake up today?
I think it was close to about 1 o'clock today when people noticed that a lot of riot police outside all of a sudden, and they just immediately started beating the door in.
So it seems like they turned up pretty quickly. Personally, I thought it was quite good timing on them, because I was sitting in the middle of an extremely boring meeting, which has been broken up by the call out that the door was getting bashed in. So pretty much chaos ensued immediately from that point on.
And you had prepared some sort of barricades already. How did they hold up?
I hear the front door lasted a reasonable amount of battering. I don't know,
The police were quite... I heard them talking in the street afterwards. They were quite impressed by our barricades and quite annoyed by how long it took us to get through. But there wasn't much we could do once they were inside the building.
So once they got in, what happened then?
Well, a few of us ran up to the first floor and started barricading the doors there, pulling up floor panels and stacking them against the doors. And but they were actually very heavy, and they lasted quite a wee while before they battered their way through. And you went up to a different level, didn't you?
Yeah, we went up to the second floor, and there was actually a metal shutter on the door that way they were trying to get through. But they eventually got through that, and we all just went and sat down on the floor and gave it up, and they were obviously spoiling for a fight. And people downstairs I heard later, I'm sure my friend here would be able to fill us in, was there were tasers, and I don't know, a few people got the crap kicked out of them. But where we were, they were really spoiling for a fight, obviously, but I think their officer just barely kept them on the leash when we were all sat down and not making any active resistance.
When the first policeman managed to break half of the door down, we couldn't get through the barricade. There was one of them swinging at it, truncheon around at anybody that came near him, and another one was aiming at people with a taser gun. But at that point, we all went and sat in another room, because there was there's nothing more we could have been done at that point. But yeah, you're right, they were very hyped up, and luckily enough, there was a couple of people there who were telling everybody to calm down, because some of them were spoiling to crack a few more skulls, you know.
And so once they got to you in the rooms, what happened then?
They didn't tell us straight away why we were being arrested or what legislation they were using or anything like that. They just said, hands up. They told a couple of us to lie down face down on the ground. A lot of people started asking straight away, what grounds do you have for invading in here and all that? And they said, we'll explain all in a while, you know.
Thank you very much. Just to keep you informed, you're being detained here, okay? In a few moments, you'll be taken out one at a time, okay? When you get outside, okay, the big bosses will tell you exactly why we came in. Simple as that.
Then they told us that we are... The way it worked out in the end, they were pretty sketchy on it, and they did actually go back on their words, you know. Like, one copper said one thing, one said another. There was a big difference between being suspected of violent behaviour and being arrested for violent behaviour. So once you were arrested on suspicion of violent behaviour, you would be brought over to the building. Then you will be actually de-arrested, or else you'd be arrested for violent behaviour, I think. So they were two separate things, I think, but it wasn't very clear. And they brought us down in groups of three
and searched us, took us outside, like right, the same, got our details and recorded us, and then they were comparing those images to images on the protests, and then if they decided that you had done something that day before, then you got taken to the police station. If not, you got de-arrested. Like there was one guy who'd been arrested, chatting to the police officer, and the constable only found out about 20 minutes after arresting him why he'd been arrested. He's like, so why is he arrested? And then what the commanding officer had to say, it was for, you know, suspicion of violent behaviour. He's like, oh yeah, that's why you're arrested.
They did kind of seem to be making it up as they're going along, a lot of them.
And so they just let you go then, or what?
It took a long time for, obviously they were cross-referencing those photos, and that took the most time, and eventually they started saying that, yeah, we don't recognise anybody, so you'll probably be just de-arrested at some point and let out to outside the lines.
I think they arrested around three people. They kept two away. Then one guy I spoke to, they told the guy that's sitting next to me, when we're still waiting to find out whether we were going to be de-arrested or not, was told that he was getting taken to the police station. He was going to still be under arrest, and they had photos of him throwing a bottle, and he said, told me quite clearly that he hadn't been throwing any bottles or anything. So their evidence, their information seems a bit mixed up. I don't think they really understood, a lot of them, why they were going in there. I think they were maybe looking for specific people and they didn't really find them. They seemed to be really confused that they weren't finding weapons and all kinds of stuff in people's bags. And they were, like, one guy was searching a bag and said, I suppose you've got lots of flags in here. And the guy whose bag it was just like, no, just clothes, really.
So we love flags, don't we? I mean, all in all, like, how do you feel about the experience?
Well, it was a beautiful, beautiful space, like, and it was a really, really lovely atmosphere there. And I suppose some of the people were involved in setting up, and they thought it was a great victory to actually have that space so close to the city, and to have it so nice. Yeah, it's sad to lose it, obviously, because it could have been amazing for a long time, but... Yeah, I think all in all, we came out pretty well from it, you know.
It's a bit, it's kind of scary in a way, because the legal basis for what the police they were doing was, seems a bit dodgy anyway, and certainly the way they carried it out, I think there was a lot of problems, and the legal observers that I talked to were pretty shocked by people's reports. Unfortunately, we didn't have any legal observers in the building with us, I think, but if they did have legal grounds for busting into the place like that, it's a bit scary for squats, because we had a section six and whatever sign outside all the time that we were in there, and they had no grounds for coming in and evicting us. It was just they could come in like if it was had been any property, because they could say we suspect there's violent people inside, and then of course once they're in, then we're no longer in possession of the building and they can chuck us out. So they basically broke up the squat using a different piece of legislation, and it seems, and I'm sure that was why they were doing it, rather than because they could easily, if they just wanted to arrest people who they'd seen at the demo and then had gone into the squat, they were already stopping and searching every single person who tried to exit the building, so they would have caught them that way anyway. They had no need to come in and beep, they'd beep a few people up and as they're coming in and wrecking things and just, yeah, going a bit G.I. Joe.
Yeah, not too bad, thanks. Warren 1 is quite disappointed by the outcomes of the G20 because they failed to address any of the systemic issues which have been led us to this crisis. They've effectively just chucked a lot of money, even more money, at failed ideologies and failed structures and failed institutions of the past, and they've not seized the opportunity to really put the global economy back on a new track, which is absolutely urgently called for. If you look at what's come out, what's been trumpeted, in all the media. It's that the IMF is the big winner of this, and you can see that they've tripled their money, which is available to lend to other countries. They've got another $250 billion to have special drawing rights, which is a kind of alternative currency. And they've become somehow the global overseers of our financial system and charged with keeping us on track. Now, anyone with a passing acquaintance with the last 10 years can see that the IMF really has been one of the bad guys. It's been an absolute disaster for developing countries particularly. You know, you get a poor country which is in trouble with its balance of payments, doesn't have enough money, it goes to the IMF, the IMF says, right, we'll bail you out as long as you do this, 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 and this, which has inevitably ended up making those economies worse. So, you know, giving a whole lot more money and a whole lot more power to the IMF is just ludicrous, frankly, and they have made noises about reforming it, but without any real detail in there. And we've seen these kind of promises in the past, you know, actually almost dozens of times, and it's never come to fruition. So, you know, they have the money, but they don't have the reform. So that's the central really bad bit, I think. They've also been talking about this sort of extra $1.1 trillion finance, which is, as I say, I mean, it's, where is this money coming from? It's mostly in pledges, a lot of it, particularly what they've promised on aid, which means that there is no actual extra cash. It's either repackaging stuff that's already been promised, it's reiterating promises from the past, and it's saying that this money is available if it's going to be needed. So that gives them a nice headline. But it doesn't really do much for the fundamental changes that we need to see. And I mean, the biggest losers out of this, in a sense, is the whole climate change issue. Because as a lot of commentators have been saying, this is not just a financial crisis, it's a crisis of climate, it's a crisis of, you know, fuel, food, and it's a crisis of the system, effectively. And you can't just deal with the financial system in isolation and pretend we can just go back to business as usual. But unfortunately, that's what the G20's come out with. And nothing on climate change, nothing about greening the economies, no concrete plans there, and no, you know, clear sighted thinking about how we could create jobs, create wealth, growth, if that's what they want. And again, the details sort of he's in the pocket of finance. So it's just sort of ludicrous to put that forward as some major achievement when they're still continuing to block it, and it could have been done a long time ago if his heart was actually in it. And the last point I'd just like to say is the G20 is illegitimate. It's a self-selecting body. You've got 20 countries out of 192 in the UN, for example, and all of those poorer countries particularly are getting no voice again, despite being the vast majority of the world's population and despite being the ones that can be hit hardest by climate disaster and financial crisis and so on and so forth. They're not at the table, they're not getting a voice about what the priorities should be. The G20 fails to recognize that, fails to do any sort of meaningful engagement with those other countries as well, or to bolster the UN process. It's really sort of just continuing the trend that we've seen in the past. So, I mean, the only positive thing I'd say about it is that it sort of reaffirmed multilateralism, internationalism, the fact that we do have to address these things on a global level, which, you know, in the longer term, if we're going to get towards regulation that will keep multinational companies in check that will stop them running circles around countries, around regulations, and playing them off against each other to get the biggest tax breaks. Yeah, in the long term, we've got to have some global structures that will look after this. But what's the G20 come up with when presented with the opportunity to do this? It's just more of the same, more business as usual, a lot of money and no real no vision and no leadership, frankly.
Yo, we're back.
Yeah,
we're back.
Puget Sound from
the homeland, Dublin.
Dublin.
Woo! Kind of from Wicklow, but we claim that as Dublin's own. Anyway, so we're here with Luca now, who's part of an event running at LARC, which is a sex workers open university. Welcome, welcome, Luca.
Hi. Yes.
So how's it going?
Yeah, really good. We're really pleased tonight with the opening of the art show, Prostitutes of Europe. And it's like photographs and paintings downstairs at LARC and some videos in the library room. And yeah, we're really glad there was like maybe like 60 people came.
Brilliant.
And yeah, it's really good.
Yeah, so what is going on here?
What is
the Sex Workers Open University all about?
Well, it's an event that's happening all week. It started on Tuesday with a demo on Piccadilly Circus for sex workers and allies. Wednesday there was a conference at Queen Mary University with sex workers coming from Denmark, Germany, New Zealand, England, and academics and activists like feminists talking about sex work and criminalization of sex work. And this weekend we have like plenty of workshops at LARC, and Sunday a big party at Rampart. And the idea is like to bring together sex workers, activists, academics, allies, artists to explore the world of sex work, of the sex industry. And because right now the government is trying to pass a new law to criminalize sex work. So it's just like, for now, they just like want to criminalize clients of sex workers controlled for gain, which could be like, oh, it's great. Like, we actually want to like criminalize not the sex workers, the clients of trafficked people. But that's how they make it sound. But actually, it's a really racist law and really sexist law. They actually want to like find another way of like, how do you say? Deporting migrant sex workers. Like most of the migrant sex workers, they're not trafficked. They are migrant. They are paperless, and they work in the sex industry. That doesn't mean they are trafficked. But like the government is trying to like get rid of them. And even Jackie Smith said like she wants to actually like get rid of prostitution altogether. Which
do you reckon her husband thinks the same thing?
Yeah, I don't know if they talk. I don't know if they talk about it. I think that's really like so funny that it happened just this time. Like we're doing a sex worker up in university, and he's like caught up like watching porn. I mean, that's pretty funny.
Well, it's funny because she is trying to push through quite a few laws in relation to even viewing of pornography or possession of pornography. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, her only ally during this whole event with her husband has been from the very group she's been trying to shut down, who said, "It's all right, Jackie, you're allowed." So in terms of what's been going on this week, you're saying you've been at universities and things, so you're doing workshops and lectures, is it?
Yeah. So Wednesday was really great. It was at Queen Mary University, and we had like workers from like Denmark talking about the situation there, like in New Zealand, like most of the countries who are like facing criminalization are taking New Zealand as an example, where sex workers has been decriminalized and people are allowed to work together. And like, I mean, it's not great in all ways. Like, it also means like only like workers from the country can work, for example. It makes it harder for migrant sex workers. But at the same time, it's a first step. Like, decriminalization is the first step. So we're like really glad to have someone who worked in New Zealand to talk about the model there, the model there. And like activists and academics who are talking about the relationship between like migration and sex work, because like if you're like a migrant without paper, like one of the jobs you can do are jobs that are actually like where you don't need like paper to work, like for example sex work. So there's like complicated like links between all this. This weekend you have like, plenty of workshops. Most of them are more like hands-on, so we have like self-defense for sex workers with like specific scenarios linked to like if you're with a client, I don't know, like on your knees giving a blowjob, and the guy is starting to like how to like react when you're actually on your knees, you know, like practical tip for like sex workers, things like this.
Well, I suppose it's good obviously for these sort of people who are generally isolated by society to obviously have a chance to talk together.
Yeah. Well, that was when the main aim was like actually like to bring us together and like to have like a space and time like to debate and like share ideas. And it's great because like it wasn't intended to be like a radical event. Like it's just a space for people. But like most people who came from Europe and to this event are quite radical in the radical scene. And we had like great evenings, like all the like sex worker like stay in my house. Like these great evenings, like talking about relationship to like capitalism and like patriarchy and sex work. And there's like lots of great ideas of creating kind of like a network of radical sex workers. Because you can be a sex worker and you can be a feminist and you can be like anti-capitalist and anarchist. Like it can all comes together.
Wonderful. So if people want to find out about this and future events that you guys are doing, have you got a website?
Yes, we do. I was going to make a joke about like trying to find us in the street, but no. We have a website. Should I do like www.sexworkeropenuniversity.blogspot.com?
Wicked.
Yeah. Oh, then thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Cheers.
All right, cheers. Thank you. And come to the party at Rampart on Sunday. Cool, bye.
All right. Wicked. Thanks, Luca.
We have some announcements to make. For people who are G20 defendants and also people who are witnesses to people who are now going to be, having problems after the G20 is over. There's a meeting on Tuesday at 7 p.m. at Freedom Bookshop. And, come along if you are someone who needs to go to that meeting, obviously. There's a demo tomorrow on Saturday at Bank. And this is in response to the death of Ian Tomlinson. And it's also about police brutality and repression at the G20 events. And it's also about the freedom to protest. So definitely show up and go along if you're into that. And, Neil, do you have anything to say about the Enfield occupation? You went to go see them today?
Oh, shit. I didn't realize I was going to talk about it now. I was there. It was good.
And what exactly is it that they're... What exactly does the factory make and why are they doing this?
I don't know exactly what they make. They make parts for Ford, basically, and... they were told on Wednesday that they were sacked without redundancy pay or without anything. And that also happened in Belfast and in another place in England, which I forget the name of now. And basically, all three factories are occupied, and the one in Belfast, they're actually operating the, they're working the machines, they're running it. So that's very good. They are looking for solidarity. It's just by Ponders End train station, out of the train station, over the flyover, down the road towards London, and it's on Morrison Road. Just follow it around. There's lots of people there, lots of solidarity. There's around 40, 50 people outside, 100 plus inside. Yeah. It's all very good and nice. So I think people should support it, go out and say hello, because it's not just about going to the streets and smashing up an RBS or whatever you did. It's about, like, you know,
well, you know, they've had
free alternative.
Apparently they've
well.
Had papers served on them today. High court eviction papers, so they do need people to get their ass down there and send them some love. But you can check them out. They're doing some stuff with Indie Media as well, keeping updates.
Indie Media London have it on the front page and stuff. So yeah, check it out. What's on next then?
Yeah, we're going to listen to Richard from Climate Camp talk to us about the post G20 analysis.
First off, as a Climate Camper, how do you feel the event went, and what are your observations post April 1st and 2nd?
I think we did really well in getting our main message out there in terms of keeping climate change on the agenda, making sure that in the media and among, you know, independent media as much as mainstream media, that climate change was kind of remained part of the focus of everything happening around the politics of the G20 summit, which is maybe something which, you know, which hasn't happened so much in the past. And then more specifically, our message of carbon trading and making sure that people realize this is a false solution, that this is a free market solution to climate change, which just, you know, isn't going to work at all and really is part of the same kind of ideas and ideology that got us into the financial crisis.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. I think, though, that if you're coming from the perspective of someone who's consuming a lot of mainstream media, a lot of the press coverage actually tended not to focus on the issues and tended to focus a lot on the police versus protester violence and some of the property damage that happened at the RBS. And do you really feel like the people out there that are not really involved in the activist network are learning about the issues or are actually absorbing Climate Camp's message?
Well, I think what's interesting is that actually a lot of the media, I think, picked up on the climate change message which we're putting out there without realizing it. So, I mean, there was an article in The Independent today by Johan Hari, who came down to the camp and so on, very much talking to the same kind of protesters who may have been wearing black hoodies and so on, but nonetheless reporting our message about climate change. I just think it's been very much disassociated from the kind of tactics that we have to use in order to get that message across. I think it's perfectly true that, you know, that you know, our messaging has been eclipsed by, you know, a lot of the kind of tactics that the police used on us. But in terms of spiraling out of control, I think a few smashed windows doesn't really contend with the kind of actions that we've seen at, you know, G8 or G20 summits in the past at all. I think it was a very, you know, incredibly peaceful, wonderfully theatrical protest.
Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming that the protest is just one of many things that Climate Camp is getting involved in. What other sort of things are Climate Camp as a group trying to achieve in the near future? What are some of the goals that you're working towards?
Well, we've got kind of two big things coming up. I mean, over the summer, we've got quite a few Climate Camps being organized by different kind of regional networks. So there's going to, hopefully, there'll be ones in Wales, Ireland, Scotland, and then also, again, another camp in London. And probably a longer camp lasting about a week, which will go over bank holiday weekend at the end of August, beginning of September. And then after that in December, there's around Copenhagen, which is the United Nations Conference on Climate Change. There's a huge mobilization happening around that across the world, and very much a lot of European activists. And Climate Camp's making sure that we're going to be part of that, whether that's doing solidarity things around the UK, as well as making sure that lots of activists get over to Copenhagen for that.
So most of the time, Climate Camp is not trying to do any sort of anti-summit action. Most of the time, it's actually creating its own event and trying to put a message across that way. Yeah. So.
Well, absolutely. Well, this is in many ways where the kind of the climate camp idea came from, which was people after Glen Eagles realizing, you know, maybe this isn't working, that we always have to go where they are. We need to set up our own thing. We need to have our own space. And I think it's interesting now that maybe this year we're doing both. We're doing the summits and we're going to be making our own spaces in the summer. And I think it's nice that we've got the capacity and the dedication to make sure that we actually can do both of these tactics.
And how about the actual G20 summit? Are you aware of some of the decisions that were made there, some of the proposals for economic stimulus packages, et cetera, et cetera? What were the leaders putting forward as solutions to the issue of climate change, if any, and how does this climate camp feel about those solutions?
Well, I mean, we haven't had a chance really to meet at the camp and talk about it, but certainly from where I'm coming from, and I think I would speak for a fair amount of the network like this, that the way that climate change was just put on, as I think there were 29 points they agreed on, number 28 was about two sentences long, simply saying, we think that climate change is really important, and we're going to discuss it in December. I think the idea of saying that you think climate change is important, but you're not going to discuss it for another 7 months is totally absurd. Climate change is an urgent, urgent issue. That doesn't mean that we have to demand that our states suddenly all get around and kind of, you know, become incredibly authoritarian in order to deal with this issue. Far from it. But it does mean that the idea of saying that we can talk about it sometime in the future when we're going to maybe say something about it and then ignore what we say, I think just goes to show how pointless these G20 summits are. They're just this huge waste of money, huge waste of time, and the idea that anyone politically involved could think they're going to come up with anything useful is, well, for me, it's unimaginable.
Yeah, fair enough. And in the lead up to the climate camp in the city, it turned out that the climate camp actually was engaging with, or at least trying to negotiate with the police, not necessarily negotiate, but work with the police in order to somehow resolve the issues that had occurred while the climate camp was at King's North. And that didn't actually result in anything, it looks like, because the policing was really heavy-handed and just completely over the top. Do you have any perspective on what's going to happen in the future, because it almost seems like things have gotten a lot worse than some of the policing of protests in recent years, and it's have to respond to that.
I think there are a few things here. I mean, one, in terms of, you know, did we achieve anything in terms of the King's North parliamentary review? This time around, the officers were wearing numbers on their uniforms while they beat us up. So, I mean, if we can see that as progress, maybe it's a bit of progress, though maybe not the most important area. But they were very much responding to this, so we do have some kind of clout when we make these kind of these complaints and so on. We bring these through official channels. In terms of, you know, what's been slightly, I think, falsely dubbed a negotiation on Tuesday, I mean, what we did is we just made sure, well, we'd been saying we wanted to liaise with the police. They eventually decided this was a good idea after it got a lot of media attention that they'd been ignoring us. It wasn't a negotiation process. We simply said what we'd be doing. They said things like, we categorically say we won't be deploying tasers, which they didn't at the camp itself, but then, of course, yesterday when they cleared out the squats, there were police armed with tasers in order to threaten activists. So yes, maybe in some ways things have got worse, better in terms of the amount of violence used. But on the other hand, there's a huge amount of public attention being put on this. Certainly some of the mainstream papers are reporting on this. There does seem to be an outcry about the amount of violence that the police are using against us. And certainly comparisons with civil rights movement and the suffragettes are really helping us with this cause.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the manner in which the climate camp played out, which most of the time it was a very wonderful event, but it seems that the end was quite difficult for people to stand their ground with so much police force there. How do you feel that potentially deters people from joining the climate camp process or potentially being more in solidarity with people? Do you have any perspective on that?
I think this is a really interesting question, because I think a lot of people were far more put off by threats of violence from the police and so on in the lead up to the protest. I think people who stayed and were there and saw it, as you said, I think it gives people a huge amount of solidarity. I think you leave realizing how much we have in common, how much we share as activists, how much we are together. Once you start being hit in the face with a shield. Once the police are there, it really brings us together. And there were a lot of people saying that at the time, in some ways, we need to be kind of grateful to the British police because they provide us with extraordinary unifying moments. That even when we're having a peaceful protest camp, in the street in Bishopsgate, which isn't being used because it was at night time, we weren't obstructing anything, and they essentially came in, trashed our tents and knocked over our picnic tables. And it's really extraordinary that they could, be so blind as to think that that's actually going to put us off. If anything, it makes us a lot stronger.
Yeah, that's a positive way of looking at it. And how do you feel that because of all this intention on the policing of the protest events on April 1st detract from the message? Is this something I'm assuming that this is something that Climate Camp has to come up against quite often, trying to get a message across when the focus is always on how the police are dealing with it. Do you think this is a specific tactic to detract from the momentum of the movement?
Absolutely. I think there are some ways that we may be able to respond in future in terms of our tactics to try and make sure that doesn't happen. So there's been talk in some Climate Camp meetings about maybe we can find ways of spending less time interacting with the police when we're not even actually performing kind of big direct actions. So, take Kings North. We spent a huge amount of time actually maintaining our space and our campsite, stopping it, from intrusions by police and so on. Certainly almost more than the actual assault on the power station itself. And so maybe we need to think about our tactics if we can find a way around this so that we can try and get our message across there more and actually also have more time for police confrontation when it really matters, i.e. when we're shutting things down and getting across the message that, huge polluting industry, overconsumption, financial systems just aren't working and are putting us on the road to runaway climate change.
Okay. So I think that's it for the interview. But do you have anything else that you'd want to sort of announce or anything that you want to put on the radio to get a message out there for Climate Camp or anything else?
Just to say that if people came along to the camp or they want to get involved, please visit our website. We update it all the time. And we've got our next national gathering, I think April 18th in Brighton. People are really, really welcome to come along, activists, old and new, all sorts of campaigners. And because the more people we have at these meetings, the more, the stronger our decisions are when we make them collectively.
So now we have an interview which we got from Indie Media London, which is of two witnesses to the death of the protests on April 1st, and this is what they have to say.
Hi, I'm Peter. I'm a law student at the moment, and I was attending the demonstrations on April 1st concerning the financial crisis and the G20 summit.
Yeah, I'm Elias, I'm a student as well. I was also attending the same demonstration, and we were both there. We witnessed the man who's died now, and that's been reported in the papers. I'd just like to hold something up. This is the sort of thing that people are saying, police pelted going to help dying man. This is in the London Light today, and I read stuff myself, about bricks being thrown, saying the protesters threw bricks at the police while they're trying to help this man, but we both witnessed what happened.
Yeah, we're both here to give our account, our unbiased eyewitness account of what happened. Around 7 o'clock in the evening, we were in an area to the east of the Bank of England near Bishopsgate. We were with a crowd of protesters. There'd been a few clashes down that road between police and protesters immediately beforehand. And I looked up, I saw a man in his late 40s. He was stumbling along. He looked unable to, definitely unable to walk properly. I saw him, he collided with a door that came out of the building and then walked a couple more steps and collapsed. And the person I was with, who's got some experience in first aid, went running over with another group of protesters to see whether he was okay. And he was clearly in a bad way. I remember the person doing the first aid put him in a recovery position, tried to take his pulse, which was weak. We looked at him, he couldn't answer questions. We asked him his name, was whether he'd been drinking, just tried to get a response from him, but he was definitely unable to understand the questions we were asking. I remember his breathing at one stage became like snoring, which I'm told is a sign of, I don't know the medical background to that, but that's what I was told.
Yeah.
Agonal breathing, I think is what it's called. So my friend who was a first aider was trying to provide help for this guy, and a police charge, because they were trying to clear the protesters out of this road, a police charge sent a lot of protesters running towards this man, and the girl who was providing first aid stood in front of him to make sure he didn't get trampled. And then we returned to where he was on the floor. There was a man called an ambulance. He spoke with the ambulance advisors, who advised that he'd be laid on his back. Then someone had notified the police, and they sent 4 PCs and 2 medics to find this guy. They arrived, and they removed the people attending to him forcibly. They didn't really want to listen to what anyone had to say about his breathing or his pulse or anything. At this stage, not everyone in the crowd knew what was going on, that a man had collapsed. And I saw there was one bottle that was thrown towards the police. It struck the wall about 10 feet above them and some distance, I guess, to my left of them. But then after, the crowd instantly turned around and said, there's a man collapsed, there's a man hurt, stop throwing things. After that, nothing more was thrown. And the police began attending to him, and medics began doing their job, I suppose. And after that, like, further police charges just pushed us out of the area. And that was the last I saw of him. I saw 2 ambulances enter the road, what would have been about 15 minutes later.
This has become, you know, like, you know, the big headline. This has become, like, you know, epitomised how bad all the protesters were. We were there, it was nothing like that, and the whole thing's become incredibly distorted. The protesters were the people who were there in the first place, helping this man who had collapsed. There was a guy using one of the, you know, the loudspeakers saying, does anyone know a medic? Does anyone know a doctor? Can someone call 999? That sort of thing. There were people around him, very, very concerned. One of our friends was there helping him out, put him in the recovery position, and there was a guy ringing up the ambulance, you know. I mean, so people were there, really, really concerned. The protesters weren't, you know, these, you know, destructive people who were just letting this guy die, not in the slightest. The police came up and shoved people out of the way, as is their normal sort of style of, you know, dealing with these things. And there were, like, I mean, you talk about, I mean, it says here that, you know, police officers came under a barrage of missiles as they tried to save the life of a man. I mean, listen to the language, you know, who collapsed in the middle of the G20 protest as they tried to save the life. The people who were saving his life initially were all of the protesters and the people there who were trying to help him out. You know, and then the people at the back, there were some people at the back, and I personally went over and told them to stop throwing it, like one, maybe 2 bottles. Okay, that's not a barrage. I told them to stop doing it, and they were like, okay. You know, and the police were not under a barrage. You know, the way it's being represented there, and it's now become this massive headline, that's completely false. I mean, it's nothing like what we experienced firsthand, what we saw, you know, and what we know really, really happened. And it's really, really important that people, you know, hear what we've got to say, because we were there and we saw it.
And just the idea that any missiles in any way prevented the police providing care for him is just absolutely...
It's absolutely wrong. It's absolutely wrong. And we had people in the crowd who come up and were helping him straight away.
Yeah.
And also, I would say, you know, the mood of a lot of the protests, especially in the climate camp, which I went to see, was incredibly positive, you know. And the people there, it was like a festival atmosphere. And the police, you know, very, very provocative. When they come in, they get really heavy-handed. They elicit a kind of violence from the people, and it's a reaction. It's, you know, when they resist being moved, because that's the whole point of the protest, you know.
At this stage, we don't know, and no one knows the cause of this guy's death.
Yeah.
Like, we don't know what's happened to him. I mean, I would say throughout the day, I saw acts of brutality by the police, and I saw them swinging truncheons at people, And I mean, we're not speculating as to the cause of his death because we don't know it. But I mean, there's been reports coming out saying that he's died of natural causes, and that hasn't been confirmed yet. When the police arrived, the four police constables with the two medics, like I said, they forcibly removed the person who was treating him. They, so I'm told, refused to speak to the operator who was from the man who called the emergency services. And then once we saw that, you know, the medics were taking control of the situation, we retreated, and we were pushed back by further police charges out of the street entirely onto a much larger crossroads. And that was, we waited there for a further at least 20 minutes before we moved on further. And in that time, we saw the ambulances arrive. And the ambulances were cheered on by the protesters. They were given thumbs up, saying, and all that. And they went down the street through the police line. And like I said, I didn't see the ambulances come out. That was the last I saw of the guy.
Yeah, the ambulances came through. I mean, they had some difficulty with the crowd. You know, that people had to be moved and so on, but there wasn't any resistance.
The crowd did definitely cooperate.
Oh, absolutely. Well, yeah, there's no question of that.
I mean, that's just another thing, like, we keep saying it, but there was the attitude of the crowd was only, there's a man hurt and we want to help him.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that was it. There was no ulterior motive of anything like that, and that's all people there were thinking.
And literally, there was a boo that went up when the police came out, because literally, I mean, you couldn't tell, there was a whole load of them up, dressed up, just like most of the ones that are bashing people up. And they came out and they thought, oh, they're just going to move us on ahead. And yeah, so that's why
they
people,
thought they were going to arrest someone,
you know,
or something.
Yeah. And so it was like, you know, so people probably just saw the yellow coats and all that sort of thing. But yeah, people who knew what was going on, the protesters, were, you know, reproaching them for throwing it. And, you know, and there was a lot of anger towards the people who did that.
Yeah.
And then it just stopped.
And
know?
Yeah, once the word spread through the crowd that there was a man hurt, nothing was
Yeah, I mean, they're basically, you know, when I read these things in the paper, and they've been all over all sorts of newspapers, and I've seen things that are factually wrong in The Guardian, I've seen things that are wrong here, you know, I mean, and there are all sorts of different reports. I mean, the fact that the newspapers are reporting the stories differently shows that they're not getting something right.
Yeah.
And I know for a fact that, you know,
I mean, I would say, like, particularly the person who provided first aid for him was extremely brave in staying with him when people charged towards us. And considering that the people were compassionate towards him and people were brave and trying to protect him, it's really disappointing to be portrayed in a way that makes the people there look vicious or criminal.
Yeah,
that was not the attitude.
I'd like the newspapers to qualify, you know, these descriptions. I'd like them to say.
I'd like to know where these reports came from. About
what's the source, you know? Yeah. Because I mean, nobody asked, you know, any of the people.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we had to look into it to find out. You know, and we've definitely completely confirmed that we know that the man who was there was the one who died.
Yeah.
We know that this is the man who's died. And you know, so there's no confusion there. You know, the way it's been described has been completely false. And the whole time that we were nearby, I mean, like, the crowd had moved on not long after, because there's another wave of, you know, the police moving them up. So I don't think we missed anything.
I mean, all the time that the police were there and the crowd were there, I mean, we were in that crowd and we saw the guy. We were right on the front line of that crowd. There can't have been a stage where the police were came under a hail of missiles and that we just, you know,
that we suddenly missed. You know, I mean. I mean, it's, to be honest, I mean, it's such a, you know, it's such a sort of extreme, you know, sort of depiction that, you know, it's hard to take it seriously anyway, you know, the sort of the whole thing. I mean, the whole language is very dramatic, you know, when you read the newspaper things, and, you know, especially in the tabloids, it's like, you know, all the anarchists, the thugs, you know, all that sort of thing. Now, I mean, I don't approve of the violence that happened in RBS and so on, but the thing is that that was only a minority of the people who were involved in the whole process. And, you know, there are legitimate things that people are protesting about, deeply, gravely worrying things that are going on at the moment. And the people have a right to protest in a robust democracy. And it's a sign of health that people go out and do that. These protesters are normal people. You know, we're not going to let a man die. The whole depiction has been, you know, so grossly distorted. And it is... It's just, you know, I know that what they're saying, the reports are not correct. They're not true and factual based on my experiences and those of all the other witnesses, and there's several of us, you know, who saw exactly what happened.
All right, cool. So that was two dudes talking about what happened on the first. And we have some people here who were at the events and watching a bit of the media from what was going on and things. And we just thought it'd be interesting maybe to have a chat about the relationship between the media and the protesters, effectively. So we have Humphrey and we have Bruce and obviously Chickpeas on the mic here as well.
Yeah.
But so, I mean, one of the first things I'd like to ask, just in relation to having been at the protests and what you may have come across in the media afterwards, did you think that Climate Camp had a distinct media policy which they applied? I mean, when they were on mainstream TV and when they're being quoted, it was from a media group of people who were doing messaging. And the G20 meltdown had something like that, but it wasn't as effective. Do you think that made a big difference to the way they were reflected in the media?
Well, I don't know who was doing the, if there was a coordinated media presence for the climate camp. I don't know, but just watching it as an, from looking at the media, I didn't get that impression. I think that you get the impression, you know, they're highly organised and whatnot, but it didn't seem that they were allocated spokesperson. So I don't think, I don't even know if they wanted to actually get their message across through the media. I don't know if that was a plan or not, but to me, it didn't seem apparent.
But in comparison to the G20 meltdown group, for instance?
Well, I'm not sure, yeah. I mean, I'm not quite understanding how you want to compare the two, really, but...
Well, one had a media policy and the other basically didn't seem to have one.
Yeah. I was subscribed to the media team list for the climate camp over the last few weeks, watching it develop, and the climate camp has enjoyed having a dedicated team for the last few years working on getting out key messages, and they were quite horrified by what was coming out in relation to the G20 meltdown, in particular the way that specific individuals were getting a lot of airtime saying some quite outrageous things, which pissed off a lot of people involved in both mobilizations. One thing I noticed was during the day on the first, the coverage during the day very much had this, the mainstream media very much had this divide between kind of good protester, bad protester, the violence taking place down at Bank and the fluffy hippies sitting in tents up at Bishopsgate, and they, you know, very much kept that narrative throughout the day, to the point of ignoring what went on in the evening, because that would kind of mess up their easy story.
Well, then that leads to a question about the coverage of the media, in the mainstream media, and that basically the journalists and the cameras were there at the protests until about half seven, and then the sort of good versus bad protester coverage stopped, and then all of a sudden late in the evening you got all these reports about, you know, it just turned ugly and like protesters got violent type of thing. But basically, do you think that affected the way that people viewed the event in the end? Like, did that sort of concretely like put the idea that it was sort of like the bad anarchists versus the good sort of group that wants to work with the media and the government and the police as well, because there was like the rumor that Climate Camp was working with the police and stuff.
That's an interesting rumor. I've not heard that one. I think the Climate Camp was quite successful on the run-up to the event and getting its issues across, and then on the day the coverage has been totally saturated by, you know, images of people with blood running down their faces. And while the camp media team might have managed to get some of the issues across on the day itself, certainly the overwhelming, looking at the kind of the letters pages and stuff in the papers, you don't get the impression that kind of generally people have picked up on any of that. They've just seen the stereotypical image of rioting.
Well, do you think then that perhaps in relation to how protesters portray themselves, that, you know, the media is always going to be biased towards showing someone who has blood coming out of their head?
Well, yeah, every media. I mean, indie media was no different. You won't look at any of the articles on indie media over the last couple of days actually looking at the issues. It's all about the police confrontation, the raids, the abuse of power, and you know, all those kind of key messages that people might have been trying to get across that motivated them to go out there are kind of lost. And I think that it's the media of any of mainstream or otherwise, they look at the conflict and the spectacle.
But that's only a natural response to the fact that a lot of the event does end up becoming about the policing and the police response, the fact that there's so many of them there, the fact that they're being brutal towards protesters, blah, 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 blah. And so it's only normal that the mainstream media is going to be covering that, because that's basically what's happening. And how do you think that there could be a response where that wasn't the message that was out there? How can that change? Like, how do you approach that and try and actually put a message out as opposed to all this police sort of heavy reporting?
I don't think if there's going to be a revolution, it's not going to have a sound bite, you know. I think if you compare the 28th March, there was no violence there. But just watching the TV coverage when I got home, it's like the reporter ends the piece with, well, first of all, he complains that there's so many different messages and it's not one single one that really seems to annoy the media. And then at the end he said, if there is one message that's clear, it's fix the economy. And I'm like, no, that's not the message. it just doesn't seem to be, it seems very difficult to get any sort of message across. And it's just amazing how consistently the media manages to avoid getting any accurate message over.
Yeah, you can always rely on them. And do you think what did you think of the alternative media coverage over the events? I mean, did they have significantly different things to report on, for instance, or was it always, well, were they following the same lines, basically?
I was in a slightly strange position on this, in that I was aware that there's a very strong blur taking place in where the alternative media was getting its info from. So the stuff on Indie Media Dispatch was being confirmed by the fact that people were watching it live on the television and being able to say, yes, that's definitely happening, I've just watched it on Sky. You know, which is a kind of weird. And then there was the whole Twittering thing, which this year has been phenomenal, despite it being completely crippled as a useful form of communication for, like, actually acting on it on the street. But plenty of information was coming from the streets, from Twitter, which I found really interesting. That's definitely the first big event I've seen where it's really, really kind of come into its own.
All right, cool. So, overall, what was your favourite bit of coverage? What would you remember coverage?
The media coverage.
My
favourite bit was there's a film on YouTube of a Channel 4 reporter doing a piece to camera, and a protester sort of shoves him out the way and says, anything you hear on Channel 4 is shit. And then, I don't know if you've seen that, but that was good. I like that.
I think I've got two favourites. One is the woman picking up the like metal post with a CCTV camera, and in front of loads of TV cameras, kind of repeating the smashing of the window, even though you can see that it's already been smashed and it wasn't her, it was somebody else. That was quite cool. But my favourite bit was the bit that they repeated over and over again of I love riot porn, it must be said, you know. It was this kind of aerial shot, this huge frothing mass of people with all these yellow jackets retreating into a tight little bubble, completely enclosed, and having to climb over fences and up onto something around a monument. They showed that over and over again, and I loved that.
Brilliant stuff. Oh, it was nice to see the cops on the run. So thanks very much for coming in and talking to us about that. Next up, we're going to have Ronan. Going to play some tunes. Catch us again.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
Yeah, I don't know what the next show is, but it's like the first Friday next month.
No,
this is the first Friday of the month. Wow. Yeah. All right, cool.
check my notes. Johnny Walker Black. I like to drink when I drive.
With each cardboard, size or sign. spit tight, can't stop, arse lot, nigga, hit him high, high. Hard knocks, I start him off, I can't be cross the Palmer off. These gloves, I'm leaving off, that nigga gonna hit him high, high. Spit more, hit your, back to the beat, then kick more. Letting off heat like big balls, my cracks like heads on brick walls. Heads in the game, yeah, that fast. So slap, dash, no man, that's when I'ma gonna hit him high, high.
So we hit him high, high, then we hit him low, low. Sit back and relax and enjoy the sickest show. So we hit him low, low, then we hit him high, high. Bees up in the air, let's see him hit the sky. So we hit him high, then we hit him low. Sit back and relax and enjoy the sickest show. That's why I'm winning mine, man. You don't wanna bother, I've been stick clubber. And you're getting high, high, high. Oh, you know that, you know that, you know that. Don't give a shit, you're on the track. Yes, everything from the top. You can always bank on a syndicate. It's infinite, my rhymes stay intimate. If you say you're not into it, you're a shit liar. Cause I spit fire like a jacket, like a jacket. So we hit him, then we hit him, hit him, hit him. Sit back and relax, and relax, and relax. So we hit him, low, low, low. They say I'm tapped, so I guess I'm wet. And I love stress, stress, stress. Even if I'm living in the house. More stopping, I'm talking, I'm talking, I'm talking, I'm talking, I'm talking, I'm talking, I'm talking. It's compelling what I'm telling, 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 I'm telling,